if we can call the meeting to order. And thank you to everyone who's been able to come here today with the nice weather. The weather in Minnesota is gorgeous. Particularly up north, we love to have the snow. Skiing is available. Snowmobiling is available. The roads are good. Come up north and spend some money now. But it's good to have a white Christmas available for all of us for the holiday season.
You do.
Before we start, a couple of announcements. If everyone can turn off their cell phones, not just silence them, but turn them off, because we are going to be broadcasting the hearing, and it does interfere with the broadcast, so I'd appreciate that. Secondly, there are some unabridged copies of the thick copy of the report from the Department of Finance on the forecast, and they're available. We didn't put them in your packet, but they're available for any members if you want the unabridged report. It's also on the web as well. I think it's 66 pages, and Joanna will help anybody that we don't have a page, so Joanna will pass out to anybody who wants the unabridged report. Second, another announcement is welcome to a new member. Steve, welcome. I think it's your first time at the Ways and Means Committee meeting.
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. And we welcome you to the committee, and we expect you to make a good vote. But we are very happy to have you, and welcome to the committee as well. We look for your input. Most of us know what the number is on the forecast, but this is an opportunity to get a little bit more in-depth view of it if you want, and an opportunity to ask specific questions of the people who put this together. So Dr. Stenson, Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Showalter, do you want to come before us? It's your show, so we'll let you conduct the meeting from now on, if you would. And members, I think as we go through, if you have a burning question, you want to have it answered right away, asked right away, or do you want us to wait to the end? It's up to you. Okay, well, we'll see how it flows. We'll try to have it informal. Welcome to the committee, and Commissioner, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Finance. Today we have the 2007 November forecast, and we're going to make our presentation as we usually do in three parts. I will provide an overview and some of the key points, and then Dr. Tom Stinson, our state economist, will talk about the economy and its effect and impact on our revenue receipts, which is probably the real story of this forecast. And then finally, Jim Showalter, our state budget director, will talk about the spending changes, which are a lesser part of this forecast.
Let me interrupt just a second for members. In your packet, you should have this one stapled together. It's a small version of the report. And on the back part of that, you will also see some slides, and I think that's what Dr. Stenson is going through. They're all in that one packet, the back part. Okay, Commissioner?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can direct you to the first slide. You see the snapshot of the 2007 forecast. It reveals a $373 million deficit for fiscal year 2008-2009. That's the biennium we started in July, and we end in June of 2009. So we're about 5 months into it. We have about 19 left. You will see the beginning balance, what we carry into the biennium, $2,245,000,000. You see the revenues reduced from the first column to the second. You see the spending notched up about $66 million, just slightly. And then finally, the reserves are $1,036,000,000. And then you see we went from $294 million surplus after the after the regular session, and then that factors in the September special session, and it's and we're currently projecting $373 million. If you take a look at the next slide, how do we get to those numbers? Just some key numbers before I turn it over to Dr. Stinson. We closed 2007 with this forecast. The books get closed for the 2006-2007 biennium, and we ended $139 million greater than what we anticipated in the February forecast and at the end of session. That shows a little bit that the next point, the weaker economy is expected, it's prospective, rather than some backwards looking. We had strong receipts through the first three quarters of calendar 2007. The projections for the GDP and revenue reductions for Minnesota are projected for the quarter we're in right now, as well as the first two quarters of 2008. And Tom will get into that in a minute. The forecast reflects a $739 million reduction in revenues, and our spending is up $66 million. 33 of that $66 million is carry forward from the 2006-2007 biennium that was authorized legislatively.
Commissioner, can I just stop you a second there for members? If you take a look at those particular numbers as I understand them and take the 139 that's up on top and subtract 33, which Commissioner just said, of the $66 million that's additional spending, 33 of that is reflected in the previous biennium, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you subtract that, you get 106. And then if you back up a little bit, at the bottom of the second one on the first page, the 294 was the ending balance, and you add the 294 and 106, you get $400 million. And the shortfall was 737 or 739, and you subtract 400, you get the 373, or, well, that isn't quite right, but plus the 33 additional money,
yeah,
that gives you the additional spending in the next biennium, gives you the number that we've arrived at. Okay?
No.
Pretty close? Yeah, that's right. Missing $1 million, that's all. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an excellent summary of how we got from 373 down to 290, from 294 to 373. And then finally, I will highlight in more detail a little later, we have a structural shortfall projected for 2010-2011 as well. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson, who will walk through our economy and our revenue receipts.
Dr. Stinson, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Stinson. I'm the state economist. This forecast was characterized, I guess, by me, but also in the papers, as coming from a slowdown in the economy, not a recession in the economy. And this graph that you see here in front of you and on the screen makes clear what's going on, or at least I think makes clear what's going on. What you see is that the light-colored bars are what the forecast growth rate was for in February for half years. The dark-colored bars are what the forecast growth rate is now. You can see that for the second half of 2007, the period that we're in right now, we actually have a little stronger growth than was forecast in February, but that for the first half of 2008, that growth rate drops, and it drops dramatically. And for the second half of 2008, it's still not back up to where it was. Now, the first point is that this is a slowdown in growth. This isn't a recession. If it were a recession, that black bar would actually be going negative as opposed to be going up. so we have a have even more of a drop than we have there. The second point is that this is all prospective. What we are expecting is that the current quarter, the quarter that we're in, is going to have a growth rate of somewhere 1.3% or so, compared to what economists would normally say would be trend rate of growth of 3%. Then in the first quarter, we'll only grow at a 0.7% rate, in the second quarter, a 1.6% rate. For the half of the year that we have, that's a 1.1% growth rate versus the 3% growth rate that we had before.
Chairman, as I understood, you were going to take questions.
I think we probably, as we go through each one, we'll take questions. Representative Carlson?
I could wait, but on this particular graph with U.S. economic growth, the business section of the paper last week, I think the headline is something like White House revises growth projections, and they changed it from a projected growth of 3.1% to 2.7%. And the question I have is that change reflected in these charts, being that that was just an announcement by the White House last week, but I think prior to your forecast going public?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson. The White House forecast of 2.7%, I can't remember whether it was 2.7 or 2.8, is not part of this forecast. This forecast is prepared by Global Insight, and it is a different forecast than would be coming from the White House. There was another piece of information that was released last year, or last week, or the week before last. It's also not incorporated in this forecast, and that's what the Federal Reserve's forecast is. Their forecast for calendar year 2008, real inflation-adjusted gross domestic product growth in calendar 2008, is a range, and the range extends from 1.8% to 2.7%. The White House forecast is clearly on the optimistic side of that range. Global Insights is clearly on the pessimistic side of that range, but they're both within the range that was expected by the Federal Reserve. What this demonstrates is that while economic forecasts are never identical from one forecaster to another, that there is a wide range of possible outcomes here, that we could easily see something much lower than normal, or we could see some things could be better than was expected. I think that in the time since the Global Insight forecast has been presented, that economists and forecasters in general have grown more pessimistic about the outlook for the economy. There have been a number of events that have created more concern about the overall economic outlook, and we talked about a little bit of that at the briefing, leadership briefing on Friday. But still, this 1.9% real GDP growth, if there is kind of in the ballpark, a reasonable starting point there.
Thank you.
Continue on.
Okay, the third thing that I want you to see out of this graph is that after we reach the end of 2008, the growth rates are never quite as strong going off out into the future as they were before. Now, what that means is that the gap between where we were expecting to be off the February forecast and where we end up the end of 2008 never narrows. In fact, it expands a little bit going out to 2009, 2010, 2011. And you can see that in the two lines, the dotted line and the solid line that we have there. For 2008, in February, the forecast was for roughly 3% growth, and for 2009, the forecast was for roughly 3% growth. Now, the forecast for 2008, 1.9% growth, and for 2009, 2.9% growth. So you see, we just keep losing a little bit overall, but the big place that we're going to lose is in the first half of 2008. That translates into a loss of revenues, and the loss of revenues is on the top of page 3 of the handout that you have. All revenues are affected by the lower growth rate, but they're affected to different degrees. The income tax, because we had a higher final liability for tax year 2006 than we had projected, starts from a higher base, and withholding tax receipts up to date have exceeded forecasts, so that adds to the base. So starting from a higher base, even if you have slower growth, we end up then with $31 million more in income tax receipts than we expected. That's a small change, 0.2%. On the sales tax, we had really no change in the base. The sales tax was tracking very closely the forecast. And so what we've seen then is a 309% or $309 million decrease, about a 3.3% decline. The corporate income tax has been underperforming our estimates in February, and because it's starting from a lower base, once we go off that lower base, we have slower growth as well as a lower base. That brings the corporate income tax down by $318 million, or 14.3%. You might remember, Mr. Chairman, that last year we told you that we were not as optimistic about corporate income tax receipts as Global Insight was, and that we would bring the forecast down. We were bringing the forecast down more in line with CBO's forecast. Turns out that we were too optimistic, even though we weren't as optimistic as Global Insight was. The fourth line here is all other, $143 million, about a 2% decline. The principal portion of that that's down is the deed and mortgage, are the deed and mortgage taxes. They're down a little bit more than $100 million from forecast, and the reason is pretty obvious to everybody who's paid any attention to the housing market at all, and that is that both the volume of sales and the dollar volume of sales and the number of sales have dropped, as well as the opportunities for refinancing.
Dr. Stenson, on that issue, if the interest rates continue to drop for housing. A few years ago, we saw lots of houses refinanced, not sold, but refinanced, and we saw an increase in the deed tax because of refinancing. Is there a possibility that we may see that again in the future, or does the lack of sales have a huge effect on this as well?
Mr. Chairman, a lower mortgage rate eventually will cause houses to be refinanced. However, there are two things that are going on here that will limit the amount of refinancing going on in the future. The first is that a lot of people have already gotten their houses refinanced to a fixed rate at a very good rate, and so that rate is going to have to go down, and it's going to have to go down quite a bit. The second thing is that people were using refinancing as a way of taking cash out and spending it on other consumable items, boats, other things like that. If, as has occurred, housing prices, housing values have declined, and they're expected to decline by as much as 10% year over year between now and next year at this time, there's just less equity that you can take out, and so the cash out demand for refinancing is not likely to be as big either. There will still be some of that going on, obviously, but the opportunities for that are a lot less. That really brings me to the next point that I want to make, and it's a combination of the impact of housing and credit markets on consumption. There are really a whole set of concerns that we have about the economy right now. There are concerns that you all have heard just and seen in the newspapers, the housing sector, concern about the credit markets, concern about energy prices, and concerns about Minnesota employment. Let me start out with the housing issue. And the housing issue, we expect it's going to remain weak through the end of 2008, and in Minnesota probably weak through 2009. And this graph that's on the screen, and it's at the top of page 4 on your handout, you can see what the old forecast was for Minnesota and for the U.S. We had Minnesota housing permits coming to a low in the old forecast in the fourth quarter of 2007, then had very slow growth going on out. We now have Minnesota housing permits not coming to a turnaround point until late next summer, and really this is probably optimistic. It's more likely that given Minnesota's weather situation that building is not really likely to come back to higher than prior levels until the spring of 2009. You can see both the U.S. and the Minnesota forecast have been dropped. Global Insight's forecast for the U.S. Has been brought down an enormous amount now. We're back so that we're showing about the same kind of percentage decline as the U.S. at this point. Part of the reason for this change in the outlook for housing has been that housing sales have been weak and inventories haven't been worked down. But another part of the reason is that there's a concern that an increasing number of foreclosures will crowd the market and boost up the inventory, and that will have to be worked through as well. And this foreclosure situation is part of the credit market concern. And the credit market concern then goes beyond simply housing. It goes a concern about how much energy or fuel the credit market will be able to provide for the general economy. If you remember back from your high school or introductory economics courses, consumption is about 70% of the U.S. economy. Consumer spending is about 70% of the U.S. economy. The real concern is how does the credit crunch or the tightening of credit affect the U.S. economy and affect consumption. And here we're back to this home equity loan issue, which is part of what your question was, Mr. Chairman. The simple example of how a problem in the housing sector availability can affect the rest of the economy, we can think of as the fact that a lot of people were using home equity loans as a way of financing their automobile purchases. It made sense. That gave them tax-deductible interest, and so it really reduced the price of the loan and, in effect, reduced the price of the car to them, and so that stimulated demand slightly. Now, if you read in the papers, you see that home equity loans are less favored by lenders, and there's less home equity to borrow against, and so that's going to have an impact on the purchases of the automobiles. How much it's going to have an impact on the purchases of other things, that's what the concern is. People that are more optimistic think that it's not going to make very much of a difference. People that are more pessimistic think that it's going to make quite a bit of difference, and that the credit crunch will be such that it could bring the economy to an even lower growth rate than it's in the forecast here.
Dr. Stinson, the federal government is talking about some kind of a relief, supposedly, for the subprime mortgage, or freezing the subprime for a certain length of time. Can you discuss a little bit, give us some insight on what effect that may have on housing or the economy in general if that happens? And probably the unprecedented...
Mr. Chairman, this is just a very surprising result that occurred. The first I'd heard of this, obviously, was on Friday when it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It was on the front page of the Minneapolis Star Tribune on Saturday. This is a major concern, and I talked to a group in Roseville a couple months ago, and they wanted to know, how would you know if things were unraveling or not? If the situation was worse than you said, I gave them the usual things about, pay attention to the jobs numbers and pay attention to what's going on with the Fed and all that. And I said, but if there's something that you just don't understand, it's just completely out of the blue, that's a sign that people are really grasping for straws, and that this is a bigger concern than you might have thought it was. There's been two of these events. One is the creation of the super sieve by Bank America, Citibank, and I can't remember, Morgan Bank, where they were going to put money in for people to take a look at. The second is this. And this is really remarkable that you would be so concerned about the impact of defaults and foreclosures that you would break existing covenants on loans. Now, the dollar volume of these things is huge, and the implications are huge. If you remember, Mr. Chairman, a week or 10 days ago, E-Trade sold $3 billion worth of these collateralized debt obligations to Citadel, and Citadel purchased them for $800 million. Yeah, $3.8 billion, 27 cents on the dollar, these loans that they're buying. I mean, this looks like the size of the problem is probably being underestimated by all of us at this point. There are roughly $600 billion that we know of these collateralized debt obligations sitting out there. If you take a 30% haircut on all of them, a 70% haircut on all of them, that's a huge amount of loss that then carries forward onto the books and reduces the asset value of the banking institutions, the lending institutions that have to make do of them. There are also, obviously, global financial implications if they were to do this. We have a situation where we have a lot of credit outstanding that's held by foreign banks, foreign central banks, in particular the Chinese. There's a question as to what would happen if we abrogate these covenants in these loans and say, sorry, we said we'd reset after 2 years or 3 years, but we're going to wait for as much as 7 years to reset them. Would make seem to me that would make the investment in in these kinds of securities and U.S. securities in general is less attractive, that would cause us to have higher interest rates to fund the credit that we're getting out there. Higher interest rates would lead to even less household spending, less investment, and things like that. So this is, seems to me to be a very serious development in there, one that we'll have to pay attention to, the fact that the Secretary of Treasury is pushing so hard to reach this agreement indicates, again, that this is a serious problem out there. We have a question.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Simpson, if they don't reset, if they do allow resetting to take place, I think, and by resetting you mean an increase in the natural flow here, what is the consequence of that? Going belly up,
more foreclosures?
More foreclosures, that's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, that's also a consequence.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hart, my understanding is that the plan is to divide the existing pool of mortgages into three parts. A part where it doesn't matter whether you provide a moratorium on the reset or not, they're going to go belly up no matter what, so you just let them go belly up and deal with them. Another group that is for people that have sufficient income so that they could handle the reset. You don't do anything for them. And then there's this middle group, which is going to be a real challenge to define. You can imagine if you're somebody who said, no, we're not going to reset you because you're too well off financially, you're not going to be happy if your neighbor gets a reset on the loan. Okay. That middle group, the size of that middle group, will be determined by the institution involved. That middle group is where the savings will come in terms of otherwise lost revenue due to foreclosure. Now, how much this is worth is, you know, anybody's guess. One would think, though, that you would not agree to resetting or delaying the reset on these 228 and 327 ARMs unless it was to your financial advantage. And so that would say that if you don't do it, given that you can make this division, this three-part division that you have, that the losses would be even greater. The problem is that that just focuses on the bank's balance sheet and financial institutions' balance sheet. If you focus on what the investor thinks, once you change the rules on a class of credit, it certainly creates a situation where investors, both domestic and international, are going to be less interested in purchasing or lending for those credits. And so that is likely to push interest rates up. And I think that's the tricky thing to assess, is what's the impact going to be on what investors think in here as well.
Well, one more question.
Representative Eric.
Mr. Simpson, with all of this hanging out there, how can we say this is only a slowdown and not a recession pending? I mean, we got a ton out there that we don't even know about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, at this point, the economy is still strong. We still have, we've had very strong economic growth, 4.9% in the most recent quarter. The thought is that that we have enough of a cushion to make it through the next 6 months or 9 months. Now, part of that cushion comes from the strength of the economy in the third quarter. part of it comes from the strength of the economy that's going to show up and is showing up because of the weaker dollar. The weaker dollar has increased the amount of goods that we can export, so even though domestic consumption is declining, no, it's not declining, isn't growing as fast, that it's being made up by an increase in exports. Now, of course, that's all perspective looking out there, and there's certainly no guarantee that we're not going to go into a recession. Global Insight has a 55% probability assigned to this baseline forecast, and a 35% probability assigned to a forecast that has a recession in it. The recession is starting virtually right now, according to that forecast. Mark Zandi, who is on CNBC quite a bit and is head of MoodysEconomy.com, has more than a 40% probability for a recession. But he says, looks like a recession to me, but I'm still not going to call it as a part of the official forecast. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, as well as Deputy Treasury Secretary, one of the most competent economists around, is now saying, there's a recession. So, it's one of these things where we're not good at calling turning points, but at this point, we're saying that it's going to be slow. In February, this could all have gone by, and we could be back out of the woods and looking like things are going stronger, or we could be in a situation where it's obvious to everybody that there's a recession underway.
Thank you. Okay, Dr. Stentz, want to continue on?
Yes, sir. If I could just follow up.
Okay, sure.
Commissioner? Representative Earhart, Mr. Chair, if you go on our website and grab the, as you call it, the unabridged version, on page 10 there's an interesting paragraph in which it talks about the blue chip forecast, and that's the survey 52 economists, an economic report, and Global Insight's outlook for 2008 that Dr. Stinson's talking about faces them 48. Out of 52. So they are more on the negative side, but we are basing this forecast on their forecast, which we received on, was it the 10th or 11th? November 8th. So we're about three and a half weeks behind. So they have been a little more trending a little more negative than even, as you recall from the Council of Economic Advisors, some of the people on the council.
We're not supposed to use the word recession, or we can use our word or banana or something else. But, Okay, Dr. Stentz, you want to continue on?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart wants to be concerned even more. You should look at the next graph, on the graph at the bottom of page 4, which shows the assumption about energy prices that's in the forecast. And here, Global Insight has energy prices at $90 a barrel, oil at $90 a barrel in the current quarter, has oil prices going down to $80 a barrel in the first quarter and down to $75 a barrel in the second quarter. And you can see the light bar there is where we're at. The light colored bar is where we're at. David Weiss, the economist for Standard & Poor's, this is essentially his forecast as well. However, he says, even I, getting to the point where I don't believe this forecast either. It's just really difficult to know what's going to happen with respect to energy prices. But what we do know is that if energy prices don't follow this pattern, it's going to reduce the amount of growth that we have in the economy and a substantial deviation from this pattern would be more than enough to put us into a situation where we had negative growth. So,
Dr. Simpson, just for perspective, a year ago, what was the projection of oil prices in the forecast?
$60 a barrel.
One of the things that seems to have happened, though, is that as the economists talk about that big growth in the oil prices as compared to, 78 when we had a large growth, and the effects on the economy as a whole for that increase, it doesn't seem to have the same type of effect as quickly, anyway, as what it did in previous years. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What's happened is that the U.S. economy has become less dependent upon energy since the oil price hikes of the early 70s and early 80s. And what's happened is that even though you have large dollar volume or dollar amount changes, that those changes aren't having as big an effect as before. Now, the problem, you can think about it kind of in this way, that if oil prices go from $3 a barrel to $21 a barrel, that's a 7-time increase. It's only an $18 increase, but it increases by 7 times. If they go from $73 a barrel to $91 a barrel, that's an $18 increase again, but it's not a 7-time increase. You know, less than a 20% increase, and so that's part of what's going on. Still, after you think about it, what higher oil prices do is they reduce the amount of discretionary income that you have, the amount of income that you have that you don't have to spend for food, fuel, and housing, and so it reduces the amount of income that you have that you can spend on everything else. And that then would cause you to purchase less other goods, whatever those other goods might be. That reduces the demand, that reduces the activity in those sectors, and that causes then a kind of a spiraling down. The question is, will that be made up by increased demand from foreign sources? One of the reasons why the Global Insight forecast may come true, and the argument that they make, is that a slower economy demands less fuel, and so you will have a decrease in demand given the same supply, and that will produce a lower price. What this all comes down to, really...
I'm sorry, we have a couple of other questions. I'm sorry. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, actually, Mr. Simpson was just kind of touching on my question a bit, but what makes this chart, if you will, difficult to believe is one who reads the business pages quite a bit. Frequently there are articles talking about the increase in demand, and I'm setting aside for a moment the stability questions in Iraq and what have you, but just simply the increase in demand as a result of the rapid growth in the economies of China and India. If you could maybe comment on that a bit in terms of how that fits into these projections. Because you just referenced that they're perhaps building in a slowdown, then the chart here is going out through 2009, probably to the beginning at least of 2010. So are they predicting that that demand is going to continue to drop, even with the expanding economies in China and India?
Dr. Stenson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'm not sure what it is that Global Insight has in mind here, but here's the scenario that makes sense to me, or that I could use to justify what it is that they're saying. And that is that there's a premium, a speculative premium, on oil right now, that the supply and demand considerations don't fully support the level of $94 a barrel or $95 a barrel that we're seeing at this point. If you have a shock on the downside, if you reduce demand, that's going to take some of that speculative, well, it's going to eliminate that speculative premium, and it's going to bring things down as well. And so I think what they're saying is that if we have this slowdown, we'll get rid of the speculative premium. We may or may not get rid of the geopolitical premium that's on there as well, but that we'll be back reflecting more supply and demand considerations. There's also the fact that OPEC has indicated that they were going to provide additional output over the next few months. And so if OPEC begins to produce a little bit more, that also, that works on the supply side and brings it down. Now, you know, this is a way of justifying it. I'm not sure that all that will come true. One of the things that you have to remember is that the Chinese economy, the Indian economy, is tied to the U.S. economy in part, and tied to the European economies. And so if we have a slowdown in the U.S., that's going to slow the Chinese and Indian economies as well. It's not going to slow them to growth rates that are equivalent to ours, but it may bring their growth rate down from 10% to 8 or 7.5% or something like that, which would reduce some of the pressure on oil as well.
Representative Hilke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson touched on what I wanted to bring up. I have something in addition to that. I've paid attention to the global petroleum situation for some time now. Recently I attended the annual conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil in Houston, and I think that there was a very general consensus there that global petroleum production probably is as high right now as it is ever going to be, at roughly 85 million barrels per day. I think it's generally agreed upon by industry analysts that the only OPEC member that has any capability of increasing production in any significant way is Saudi Arabia, and that is in itself highly questionable. I don't think they have the capacity to increase their production more than to compensate for the decline of the more than 30 countries globally that whose production is in decline. So it seems to me that this assumption that Global Insights is making is just bordering on absurd. The only way you could possibly get to a flat price that much below the current one is if there were such a profound global recession that demand did drop that much. But at the same time, all of these forecasts are based not on a recession, but rather on a modest increase. And it just seems to me that we have sort of contradictory assumptions here that frankly make no sense to me at all.
Mr. Chairman, you remember that at the second Council of Economic Advisors meeting, we had one of our members, his name is Jim Campbell, who used to be the energy economist for Northern States Power and Xcel Energy, is now retired and enjoys our Council of Economic Advisors meeting so much that he drove from Wyoming to Wyoming, the state, not Wyoming, Minnesota, to attend, and also incidentally to see his grandchildren, I think. But the Council of Economic Advisors meeting is the real draw, I'm sure. He has been an optimist about the outlook for oil for a number of years. He thought that once oil prices got up above $50 or $60 a barrel, you'd see sufficient drilling, that you'd see some supply response. He came and told us that he was no longer an optimist, that he thought that oil prices could be $60 a barrel, oil prices could be $120 a barrel, and he was actually a little bit high compared to Global Insight. There are still alternatives out there. There's certainly shale oil. There's certainly Canadian tar sands that you can do stuff with. But in the short term, those are not really viable alternatives anymore. And so the question is whether by increasing drilling activity you're going to find anything more. Quite a while ago, in the 1960s, the late 1960s, a guy named King Hubbard, who was an oil analyst for one of the major oil companies, kind of posed the problem this way, and that is that if you think about it, you're likely to find all the easy stuff first. The stuff where the oil's pooled on the surface of the ground, that's not too hard to find, and then you find the easy stuff, and then you find the easier, a little bit harder stuff and all that. He projected that we were going to reach this maximum in terms of the amount that we could extract annually sometime in the late, I think originally in the late 70s, but then moved it back to the late 80s. Now it seems like maybe Mr. Hubbard's projections are probably closer to true, given that we have these relatively high, we have had these relatively high oil prices for a long enough period that drilling should have been undertaken that would add to the field.
Okay, thank you. Let's continue on with all this good news.
Well, here is kind of the summary of the national economic news, and that is what we're concerned about, and we're concerned about consumer spending, and for Minnesota sales tax purposes, we're concerned about consumer durable spending. You can see February is the light-colored line. This is a graph at the top of page 5 of the handout, and the November forecast is the dark-colored line. You can see that we're more or less on track through the end of 2007, but that this slowdown and the slowdown that we have in consumer durable spending in particular then goes on and extends out through 2009. It becomes fairly significant. The drop in the forecast of about $25 billion in consumer durable spending, Minnesota's share of that would be $400 to $500 million. So you can see that that would have an effect on the sales tax, and that's kind of what's being reflected. The other thing that is a concern for Minnesota is employment growth in the state. We've had in the past a good record in terms of what's been happening lately. The record is not good. The most charitable way of looking at it is looking at it from the growth in employment from a year ago. The growth in employment from a year ago, from October to October, is about 2,000 jobs. From 2 years ago, October, from October of 2005 to October of 2007, we gained about 23,000 jobs, or a little bit less than 12,000 jobs a year. If we had grown at the U.S. average rate, we would have added about 30,000 jobs a year. So that's a concern. Now, the question is whether you can believe these numbers or not. And there are two pieces of information that would suggest that Minnesota is not doing as poorly as you might think. One is that in terms of wage growth, the total amount of wages received by individuals, not wages per job, but the total amount of wages received by individuals, we're growing much faster. And we're growing really at such a rate that you would think that they're inconsistent. You can't have no job growth without people and 5% wage growth without having people making a whole lot of money. So it may be simply that the job numbers are being undercounted. We don't think the wage numbers are being undercounted because we get the withholding. The withholding is money in the bank, and that reflects wages. It's not a perfect reflection, but it is money in the bank, and that's what we've seen. Second is there was a New York Times article on Saturday noting that U.S. personal income numbers were being ratcheted back, and that's an indication that the U.S. Employment numbers are going to be ratcheted back. And so then the question is, will Minnesota's be ratcheted back as much as on a percentage basis as the U.S. or not? So this is a concern. This is a concern that affected the forecast. The decline that you can see from this point here, which is June, down to October, that certainly caught our attention. We had to include that in the forecast. But this is a place where the news actually might get a little bit better by February, or it might not. We don't expect that December job numbers are going to be very good because of Christmas shopping, the retail sales, the part-time jobs that are associated with that, we think are going to be below normal, and so we expect that the December forecast, the December jobs numbers will be show a decline again. But by February, things may have been picking up. So this is a concern. It's part of the forecast that's reflected in the forecast, and we want you to know that it's in the forecast, but we also want you to know that there are possible, there's possible upside to this as well as possible downside.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stenson, with respect to wage growth, are we talking about average increase, or are we talking about the mean? I'm wondering if we're not possibly experiencing what could be called the Bill Gates phenomenon, in which you can have a single person or a relative handful of people increasing their income by such a significant amount that it causes the average to go up, and it seems like everybody's enjoying that when in fact they're not.
Mr. Chairman, I want you to be clear that you understand what wages, what we're talking about when we're talking about wages. We're talking about the total amount of wages paid in the state. And certainly the Bill Gates phenomenon could be part of that. You know, a few highly paid chief executives being paid even more increases the total amount of wages paid in the state. But this is something that's gone on for a couple of years, and typically the high wage amounts that show up in the first quarter or the fourth quarter, or at some point when they're exercising options as opposed to being smooth through the period. And so while that's a possibility, it's not the whole answer. Now, it certainly could be part of the answer. We've had those from highly paid public private executives that have left employment lately, and so they may not be making quite as much as they have. Another possibility is what's happened is we've gone from a situation where we had more part-time jobs to consolidation, and the part-time jobs have been turned into full-time jobs, and so the total amount of wages that are being paid out is roughly the same for two 20-hour a week jobs as opposed to one 40-hour a week job, but we have one fewer employee because the employment numbers aren't on the basis of a full-time equivalent, but rather on the basis of the number of people actually counted as employed. So that's another possibility. This is something that we're clearly going to be taking a lot stronger look at over the next few months before the February forecast. The October numbers, the big October decline in employment really caught us by surprise. By the time it was announced, we didn't have time to do a lot of analysis of this. And we thought the September number that was there, the decline in September was probably just a seasonal adjustment problem, because there's always a lot of seasonal adjustment problems in at the end of the school year and at the start of the next school year, and so you kind of ignore those numbers. But by October, the seasonal adjustment numbers are the problems are pretty well gone, and so this caught us at a surprise.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stinson, do you have similar numbers compared to the U.S. for wage growth? You know, you show the chart here for the job growth, and you talked about how Minnesota had nice wage growth. Are we above or in front of the U.S. trend on that, or behind? What I'm trying to get at is there a disconnect between the number of jobs versus how it relates to the U.S. versus the wages and how it relates to the U.S.
Yeah, I'm going to try and put this book on here so you can see it on the screen, but it is in the book. This is something that that we show. Yeah.
That's in the unabridged book?
Yeah, the unabridged version, yeah.
And the page on that?
What we're talking about is on page 56 here, and what you can see, say, looking here at can you see that, or did
yeah, we can, and we'll share some of these books that are being passed around as well, Dr. Finn. Maybe we can share a few of these, pass them around, and we can try to get some more made as well.
If you look here, on page 56, yes, for 2004, U.S. wage and salary income grew by 5.5%. Minnesota grew by 5%. Non-farm employment in the U.S. grew by 1.1%. Minnesota, 0.8%. So what you've got is you've got 4.4% implied annual wage growth versus 4.3% here. 2005 was a bad year in Minnesota, 5.1% versus 2.7%, 1.7, 1.6 in employment. Here's where the disconnect begins to come. We've got 6.2% U.S., 5.2% Minnesota, 1.9% in employment versus 1.4%. Then for the current year, 6.4% in wages, 5.5% in Minnesota, 1.3% and 0.5%. So this implied annual wage, 5% growth in the wage per job, both there, you know, it just seems odd that we would have that in that structure, and that's the information that we have, I guess, is the way to put it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Anderson, Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Simpson, we had a little bit of a discussion of this, just a tiny bit, in our briefing, and that is the short-term and long-term sorts of strategies to stimulate job growth in a state like ours. And you shared a couple things. Could you elaborate on that? I think you talked a little bit about long-term, you know, you need to have both a short-term and a long-term strategy in this case, because we obviously our gap is growing. It's not decreasing, and it's also very different than the past 5 years where there were little blips and then it boosts back up. So I think you mentioned in that some particular things that you thought, and I don't know if they're your personal opinion or if they're things that have been discussed in the council, but if you could share with us some of those ideas or context or point us in a direction of whom we could be talking to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller. In the short term, there's not a lot that the public sector can do to stimulate employment. you can say, well, what about public works programs? But the best information we have is that on a capital budget in the next fiscal year, after the capital budget's approved, only about 15% of the money that is dedicated to the capital budget or bonded for actually gets spent. And so by the time the next fiscal year is over, we're back in a different environment almost certainly. The concern is, what can you do right now? And the answer is, I don't think we can do very much right now to stimulate the economy. Sure, there may be little things around the edges that you can do, but by the time you're able to take action, the problem is likely to be pretty well resolved, or at least on the way to being resolved by the market itself. For the longer term, you have to think about how do we get growth in the economy. And we can get growth in the economy really in three ways. We can get growth by having more people working, or we can have, this is a simple example, we can have people being more productive. And the way people can be more productive is either they're individually more productive, they have higher stocks of human capital, or that we have better equipment, better technology for them to use. What we have to be thinking about when we're thinking about long-term growth is where Minnesota's advantage is going to be. And Minnesota's never going to be a low-cost state. That's just not something that we're capable of competing with. And it's probably something we don't want to do either, compete with China, Japan for production of goods and materials. We have to be thinking that we're going to be working on the other side at the higher end. And here there are two things that we need to be focused on. One is quality. And Hutchinson Technology is an example of somebody that's able to compete in global markets, not because they're low cost, but because they're higher quality. And the people that they supply to recognize that there's a lower failure rate on their disc drive suspensions because they're using Hutchinson Technology product versus somebody else's. That reflects on their product, and people perceive the quality of their product to be good, and so they're willing to pay a little bit more. The health medical device industry that we have, I said, you know, before, and some of you probably heard me, what is it that you have here? Would you be willing to pay $500 less for a pacemaker from Joe's rather than Medtronic? And so that quality issue is important in there. So that's one of the things that we've got to be really concerned about, is how do we keep the quality of Minnesota products at a high level. That's the place where we're going to be able to compete. The second place, and the place that we're probably falling behind, is in the development of new technology, new products, net. And that comes from more research and development being funded. And faculty member at the University of Minnesota, Phil Pardee, has done some work on research and development funding, spending, not just by the University of Minnesota, but and not just funded by the state of Minnesota or anything like that, but across the board. What he found is that Minnesota's fallen behind, and that's something that we as a state probably need to be concerned about. We need to be concerned about it in part because part of the productivity increases that you get is by replacing production of lower valued, lower margin goods with higher valued, higher margin goods. It's kind of the evolution of the economy. We lose production of green T-shirts to China, but we gain the production in the production of new medical devices, and that's how we get more productivity in the state. So I think those are two issues. There's a question about whether we need more capital investment in Minnesota or not, and that's certainly a possibility that we aren't investing enough in new plant and equipment in Minnesota, and there's a question as to why wouldn't we be doing that? Is it because we don't have the cost structure anymore to attract that? But then if that's true, is it the stuff that we want to invest in, or are we willing to let some of this go offshore or go elsewhere because we're able to replace it with higher quality, higher valued production? It's a very, very challenging question.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. So when I hear you say the words quality and in terms of increasing quality, the next leap is to say that's really a human capital issue and the investment in the human capital. And that's where we have been very competitive, if not more than competitive, in terms of looking at how we fare in this economic world. So maybe you could comment on that specifically. And then, Dr. Simpson, I think that I appreciate the 15% in terms of its effect on the economy, but I think that that maybe makes us all forced to choose more wisely in terms of the types of projects we choose this next time in a capital investment bill, and really looking for those sorts of projects that are ready to go on the ground. And lots of times we choose a portfolio of projects, some that are ready to go, some that are midterm, and some that are long-term, but maybe we need to really think about that, especially in terms of any early action. But if you could speak to, when you say quality, I want us to make sure that we're understanding what quality means here.
Dr. Simpson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson Schoen. This is a thing that the state demographer and I have talked about, and some of you have heard more than once probably the spiel, but here's part of what the concern is. Here's part of what my concern is in the capital area. Human capital has become a code word for investing in K-12 and immediate post-secondary education. And that's not necessarily the place that we need to be. That was certainly the place that we needed to be. We could change the quality of the workforce, the productivity of the workforce in the 60s, because the workforce was relatively small and there was this huge cohort that was moving into the workforce. Now, more than 80% of the people that are going to be working 10 years from now are already in the workforce. And so I think that we have to think not only about how do we improve the human capital stock of people entering the workforce, but also how do we improve the human capital stock of the group that is already in the workforce and working. And those are both huge challenges. And I know that you're aware of the huge differences in high school graduation rates between white majority students and minority students that we're seeing now. And you're also aware of the fact that the growth in the people entering the workforce are a minority, that's where the growth is going to come from, increasing proportion of that group. And so this is really a challenge as to how do you meet out the resources that are needed to build up the human capital stock or provide those entering the workforce with human capital stock that's necessary to compete globally, and how do you make sure that people that are already in the workforce have the human capital stock that's necessary as well. But you're absolutely right. It's quality, productivity is really related to human capital.
Members, we do have, we're going to try to get done by in another 25 or 35 minutes, and we do have the spending side as well to go through a couple other questions, but I want, this is a great discussion, and so if we can try to keep our questions and answers a little bit we'll try to get to the spending part too, because that's important as well. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully this is a short question. Mr. Simpson, in looking at the employment figures, I just wasn't quite clear if these tell us anything about the number of jobs that an individual is working. Because I'm aware that we have people who are working two jobs, sometimes even three, to make ends meet. And I see we're below the national average in the number of jobs we're producing. You mentioned there's a phenomenon where some two jobs have now gone to one. Isn't it also true that the phenomenon is happening of one person working two or three different jobs? So what is this? Does this tell us anything about that? I can't quite tell, and it would have an impact on the wage, of course, that's being paid.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the method of what's called the CES and also the quarterly census of employment and wages, QCEW, those numbers are measures of the number of jobs, and so you are counted as employed if you work 2 hours or 40 hours in a week of reference. With respect to the question, the implication of the question, you know, is are we having more people were holding part-time jobs and multiple part-time jobs. If we were to see that, we wouldn't see the increase in the wage. That if that were going on, that would create an even larger distortion between the wage growth rate and the employment growth rate. So I don't think that we're seeing an increase in the number of people holding multiple jobs. Anything in order for the wage numbers to square with the employment numbers. We'd have to see a decline in the number of people holding multiple jobs and some people just dropping out of the workforce.
There's
a
follow-up? Just a decline or decrease based on starting when? You're talking about when these number of jobs start?
In the last couple of years.
Representative Griney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, I'm interested, I don't know if you have it in mind or if you could get information on other states. I know, you know, because we were ahead of the game in 03 and we seem to be sinking ever since. Was that the trend in Minnesota before that? And then what of other states? Is there any commonalities in the other states that are making the U.S. statistics go up compared to what Minnesota is doing?
Dr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown. Minnesota's trend prior to, say, 2004 was that we were doing better than the U.S. Certainly prior to 2001, the recession in 2001, we were doing better than the U.S. unemployment numbers. Since then, Minnesota is kind of ragged, but we've tracked more or less through about 2004, and then since 2004, we've fallen behind.
Do you have the statistics for other states available if someone would like to have those, or at least the sampling of other states?
Sure, that's easy to do.
Maybe if that's available, Commissioner, you could provide that to us and we'll get it distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when getting that information, Dr. Simpson, what I'm particularly interested in is if the states that are doing better did better than Minnesota at investing in the human capital and the quality and the research and development and those types of economic drivers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Griming, you know, I'm not sure that that's as easy to get at. In fact, I'm positive it's not. There is some information of the report that Phil Pardee has produced does show how Minnesota compares to other states on research and development. And so you might want to see if you can't get a hold of that.
We can, if you give that information, we'll try to get both of those reports and get them out to people that are interested. Representative Grayling, are you finished?
Mr. Chair, I am.
Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Simpson, when you have been before this committee or others and previous things, you talked about Minnesota's per capita income, I think, was the measurements having risen when we were a higher tax state than we are now, from somewhere 16 or 17 into the 7 or 8.
Better than that.
Well, would you repeat that for me again, please?
Okay. In the 1960s, Mr. Chairman, in the 1960s, per capita personal income in Minnesota was about 95% of the U.S. average, and we ranked about 25th. By 2005, we were on the order, 2004, I think, we were on the order of 109% of the U.S. average, and we ranked somewhere 7th or 8th or something like that. In the last 2 years, we've dropped down. I think we're now 106% of the U.S. average and ranked maybe 12th or 14th. And so there's a big change between where we were in the 1960s and now. Part of that is clearly due to quality of the workforce. In the 1960s, we had less than a 50% high school graduation level in the workforce. By 2005, we had 91%. So.
Thank you.
Representative Rukavina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hansen, I noticed in this finance handout here that you talk about the inflation for 2010 and 2011, but I don't see the inflation figure for this $373 million deficit. So if we added inflation, and what are we looking at for having to cut?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, we have, usually we add inflation when we, before we adopt a budget, to give us an idea of what it would be. But we haven't enacted budget for 2008-2009. I suppose if you were to take the 373, what would you do, Jim? Times it by the factor by point, yeah, by the 1.9.
Mr. Chair, Representative, typically...
You can just identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. We've had similar questions in the past of trying to understand inflation on an enacted budget. Typically, that's part of the factor that's included in assuming whatever that enacted budget is. Within our planning estimates, prior to enacting that budget, it's the rate of inflation around 2% or so. Once you set that budget, though, that's essentially supposed to be the amount that's available and including that factor. So we don't commonly try to calculate inflation within the budget buying, I guess is the long, short way of getting at it.
Mr. Chair, you know, just using the oil projection as an example and cost of a barrel of oil, I mean, we know what's happening out there as far as fuel oil for heating our nursing homes and schools and everything else. But so, Mr. Hansen, you know, in the past, when we've had problems like this, whether it was Kui, who I believe there's very few around the table, Representative Kahn and Representative Carlson, that were here then. But I think, didn't he have $1 billion deficit after he cut income taxes, and then you guys had to fix it up? And the same when Carlson came in, you know, there was $1 billion-plus deficit. There were a few of us here then. But, you know, being the good Minnesota moderate Republicans that they were, they balanced with their deficits with some tax increases and some cuts. Is the governor going to do that this next session, or is he still going along with his no new tax pledge and expecting us to find another $373 million to cut and hurt more people? What's going on here?
Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I'm still in shock you don't consider us moderate Republicans. We are, at this point, we have planned well for this situation. Our reserves are higher than they have ever been. We cushioned the impact of this deficit by sound planning last session and leaving some money as a cushion, as I explained at the beginning, the 294 and the 106. leaving us with $400 million that has cushioned our revenue drop. As Dr. Stinson has said, this is one of the at least he has said in some of our briefings on Friday, I don't think he has said it here yet, that this has the potential from November to February of being one of the biggest fluctuations either way. From our perspective, we are going to have our supplemental budget recommendations probably the first week in March after we see the February forecast. But after saying all that, we will not have a tax increase in those recommendations. We think government has its responsibility to look at what we've done. We have most of the money in this biennium yet unspent. I said earlier, we're only 5 months into it. We have some excess funds in the healthcare access fund and the TANF fund, which may be able to be appropriately used, which Mr. Showalter will get to in a minute. I think we have options available to us other than increasing taxes and still moving us forward.
I do want to get the taxes of Mr. Showalter. Just a second. But we do have some people that have questions, and we'll continue with that questioning. We'll get on the spending side, too. Representative Rukavina, follow up?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, it's a question of, you know, that you're not going to raise any taxes, but there's been taxes skyrocketing in this state, and there are local property taxes. But, you know, it's kind of funny, Mr. Hansen, and you were here too, you know. If we can take just a little, Mr. Chair, if you would oblige me for a minute, a little, you know, historical tour and go back to 1999 and 2000 and those income tax cuts, and then the 2001 tax bill, which spent about almost $900 million a year in Representative Earhart's district and Representative Puente's former district and Egan and Eden Prairie and Edina, the three E's, and that's fine. You know, I don't mind that, but you got to pay for it, and people have been saying that since the 2001 tax bill was passed. You got to pay for it, and you've made a lot of other people pay. You want to talk about, you know, the designers of them, those tax bills. We got the former speakers. Now, these are people that wanted to cut government. They're all in government. They're all commissioners. You got Swigum, Commissioner of Labor and Industry, making $108,000 a year. You got one of the designers, McElroy, of the transportation levy takeover, Representative Garofalo, about $270 million a year. He's a commissioner making $108,000 a year. Mulno, she's not only a commissioner, she's a lieutenant governor, but at least she took a lieutenant governor's salary. I give her credit for that. We got former Representative Abrams, who helped design everything. He's a judge now making more than the governor, and we got the governor. Everybody that wanted to cut government is making $108,000 a year or more in the case of Abrams and the governor, and they're making everybody else suffer. And I, for one, Madam Speaker, I am not going to come back in here and make more people suffer anymore in this state. And you, Mr. Anthony, you got a commissioner's job, and you were in the speaker's corner helping design all this too, but at least you took a pay cut, because I know how much you were making when you were in the Republican corner, so at least you took a pay cut. But my point is this, you know, we've seen deficit after deficit after deficit after we pretended we weren't going to see it. And until you pay for that 2001 and 99 and 2000 tax bills, those cuts and those spending increases, we're going to be in structural deficit beyond 2010 and 2011. We're there forever. And I find it ironic that the people that designed those tax bills are all sitting around making $108,000 a year that wanted to cut government and more. You know, it's pretty hypocritical. And the press gives them a free ride. I'm not going to give them a free ride. I'm going to harp and harp and harp and harp and make you sick. And I'm just waiting for somebody to talk about automatic pilot. Come on, bring it on. Let's talk about automatic pilot by not counting deficit, the real inflationary costs of government. That's all I got to say.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, now that this is brought up, I'm a little puzzled on page 6 when looking at that planning estimate show the structural shortfall. I'm a little surprised at that consideration of inflation at 1.9% a year. Isn't that illegal? Isn't it against the law for us to ever consider inflation?
You're on six on this part of it, huh? Of the chart, is that what you're talking about? Let's wait till we get there if we can. Representative, or Mr. Showalter will walk us through that. That's okay, Representative Kahn?
Oh, yes.
Okay, Representative Dunkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on with Representative or Commissioner Representative Commissioner Hanson, he couldn't afford our salary either.
They heard you. Just a second.
I know it.
Okay, Representative Kahn. Or Representative Dunkey.
Commissioner Hanson, following up on your comments and Representative Rukavina's, number one, his comments that it's structural, I agree with that. It is. I mean, we know it is. It's been there every year. Which brings up the out years. You talked about one-time monies in reserves and cash flow accounts. Those are one-time monies. And we balance pails, Mr. Chair, too. And if we do use, which we're going to see in a minute, the inflationary factor of about 2%, we're going to look at, I think it's over $1 billion, 1.2. I listened to your press conference the other day. I think that's what you reported. So your one-time money doesn't fix the out years. It's still built in structurally. Now, my direct question to you, in all sincerity, and Representative Rukavina kind of brought it up. Over many, many, many years, finance commissioners have been charged with finding out how to stabilize or make recommendations to us on how to stabilize our budgets in this state. Again, we talked about, and they're still doing it. Obviously, maybe it's easy for you once your governor's out of office, because we hear from Gunn, and Kodrowski and others, which is easy now when they're not under the nose of a governor. But frankly, I point to Wheelock as a good example under Ventura, and she was right to guide him in an expansion or not an expansion, but a spreading out of our sales tax to solidify our economy as we go from a manufacturing to a service-oriented economy. She actually advised Ventura, and he accepted it, to, and we didn't as legislators, to lower the sales tax but expand to services and other things, appraisal services like I do for a living. So there's all along the years there's been recommendations from finance commissioners as to what we can do to stabilize the seesaw that we're seeing in Minnesota economy. The other thing that's happened, obviously, is we've lost progressivity in our tax system. We've seen an explosion on the upper end of incomes. The middle class, where the greatest number of people are lower, yet we're not capturing that explosion on the upper end because we've actually gone the other way, Madam Tax Chair. So are you going to come out sometime soon with some finance commissioner recommendations to us that we can look at and talk about and throw around like other finance commissioners have, rather than just kind of riding the wave out? Because we see coming out in the future a lot more deficit than what we're talking about now that we could fix on the short term with one-time money.
Mr. Hanson, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, there was a lot there in your question, but just to first to refer back to and remind you on with this forecast, our dilemma here is not an expenditure problem. It is a revenue problem, and you will notice the sales tax, particularly the sales tax. You're right in that if we were to expand the base, I think we all, from a policy standpoint, can probably see that if you expand the base, you probably have fewer fluctuations when the economy clicks down a point or up a point. The dilemma is, can you politically ever get there? And that's something that we probably have to address at some point. Getting to where we are today, today's forecast, November 2007, shows a $373 million deficit. I don't think that, at this point, I mean, it is, we are very confident of this forecast. Dr. Stinson has outlined some of the uncertainties, and it could go either way by February. But from our perspective, raising taxes at this time for a $373 million deficit just doesn't make sense. We have options available to us without burdening the citizens of this state.
But again,
Representative Junkie.
But again, just to follow up, I'm looking at out years, and I don't think you're answering that. And sales tax is a good example. If I buy my iPod at Best Buy, I pay sales tax. Or if I go out to Amazon.com and buy it, which most people are now,
yeah.
I don't
want
pay
them
it.
To buy here.
I don't pay it. No, you can
well,
pay
you're
buy
supposed
here.
To pay it.
And you can pay it as much as you want. The fact is, you're not. Every one of us shop the internet.
Department know that you're not.
Yeah. But every one of us shop the internet and know that you don't pay tax if you go to certain, you know, most sites, frankly. So I think that trend on sales tax, other things, will continue. So what do we do to solidify that in the future, rather than watching, you know, watching this happen? And again, also on the income, are you satisfied that the income tax is stable again in 99 and 2000, we decreased income taxes by about $900 million that year, to 890, I think, which no one's brought up yet either. So you've got all these things that were built in structurally, and then we keep pointing back to this 2001 or 2000 period where things are separating and coming apart, and or we've just lost that stability we had for the 10 or 12 years prior to that. So
I'm going to kind of see if we can kind of shorten up.
I'm just wondering if
one more.
Are we going to see some recommendations for out?
Yep. Commissioner, I think the out years are a great concern for all of us, and the stability is a great concern for all of us. And hopefully you'll come with some suggestions for that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, the extent that we can make structural with structural help with our 10 and 11 budget, this biennium is helpful. But as we look forward, we have 13 months until we submit to the legislature a 2010-2011 budget. And we will, if we ever do get to the last chart,
we're going to get there.
Okay. you will see that we have a $211 million deficit based on current law, and that you add another $1.34 billion with inflation. So we have some challenges today looking forward, but we will spend our time between now and then looking at how government does its business, and the last thing we would ever do is to burden the taxpayers.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to comment about the out biennium and the use of one-time money as well, but instead of asking the question, I'll just make a comment, being that Rukavina mentioned that a couple of us were here during the Cui years. He made the mistake of spending down his reserve, and when he left office, his comment, when asked what he would have done differently, he said, maintain a reserve.
Right.
So just a bit of advice to the commissioner when you've got the governor's ear. That out biennium is a real issue, and we don't need a response now, because I think we'll have a continuing discussion on that issue as we move closer to the session.
Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to any of the testifiers or maybe any members, can you tell me, is there a statutory requirement for the out years biennium to be in balance?
To answer your question, no, there's no statutory requirement. I think since Representative or since Governor Carlson came on, what we've tried our best to do is to make sure that you look not just the 1 year or the 2 year budget, but to look at both spending and the income on the full 4 years out. And so as we get there, I think you'll see a planning estimate on the out years. Yeah, and I think it adds to our stability in state government finances if we can do that.
And Mr. Chairman, and this again would be for either the commissioner or for Dr. Stinson, the state of Minnesota, we have a tax code that is, when compared to other states, more reliant on the income tax and on the corporate income tax in other states. Is that a correct statement or not a correct statement?
Dr. Stinson, you want to take that?
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't know. I think that's probably right, but...
Well, Dr. Stinson, I think from...
Corporate
part, I think, would be not quite true. And also, the sales tax in most states has a much broader applies to a lot broader things such as food and clothing in many states. So that makes the sales tax less progressive but much more stable.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess the point I was getting at is that the path we have chosen in Minnesota, and I'll state this as an opinion and anyone up front can either confirm or disprove it, is that we've chosen a revenue stream in this state that tends to be more volatile than other states. Now, there are certainly trade-offs for that, but we have chosen a revenue system that is more unstable. And that part of the reason we see this boom and bust is because that system that we've chosen. And Representative Rukavina, we can I'll make a deal with you here today. Okay? I won't go out there and make the ridiculous assertion that the reason why we're in a deficit is because the Democrats are running around spending money left and right. If you don't make the ridiculous assertion that we're in a deficit because our tax rates in Minnesota are too low, because they're both false. The fact of the matter is, when you look at the numbers, you look at the major economic concerns in this report, we have a $220 billion annual economy in this state. We can sit here and throw rocks at each other, but that's not why this is happening. These are happening at macro forces far above our pay grade and far above us. So I won't insult you by blaming you for this if you don't do the, if you do the same thing for me and my ally.
That's Tom loving Chair. That I don't know if we can take. just a second. Okay, I want to get to Mr. Showalter, but before we do, Dr. Stenson, thank you for this, and I hope come February that your predictions of all those cautionary things is wrong. If economists can be wrong, I hope you're wrong on the low side and that it's better. But I do appreciate very much the message that you bring to us to be very cautious of what's happening to the economy. Not only in the national economy, but I think what bothers me the most is that we look at even through some tough times in the national economy, Minnesota has traditionally been better off, and we're losing that edge. I think that's the long-term thing that the speaker talked about is what we need to focus on. But thank you, both you and the commissioner, very much for coming before us today. Mr. Shaw, do you have a closing comment at all?
Mr. Chairman, I hope I'm too pessimistic.
Mr. Showalter, do you want to bring us through the last couple of pages?
Sure.
These are extremely important as well.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. The second to last page is titled Small Changes in Spending Estimates. Included in Minnesota's tradition of providing forecasts, we look at both the revenue piece and the spending piece at the same time, so that you've got a complete picture of what's happening in the state, both looking backwards as well as forward. Year to date, everything has been pretty much on track. As Dr. Stinson mentioned, revenues coming in about as expected, even slightly above. Spending has been coming in on track as well, just about where we were expecting at the end of the special session. Based on this forecast, however, we are seeing a slight change in 2008-09, increase of about $66 million for 2008-09. Half of that, however, as mentioned in, earlier in this hearing, half of that is actually spending that was anticipated in 2007. That's basically rolling into 2008. So you have a small decrease of spending in 2007, a small increase in 2008. The remainder is coming from a number of different factors here. None are high-level issues at this particular for this particular group, but certainly worth more discussion here or in the finance division. But to just give you a quick sample of some of the things here, K-12 education, slight increase in pupil counts in 2007, offset by some slightly lower spending. In aids and credits, actually, ironically, the largest increase in the spending area, one of the first times I've seen that in my history at finance. Most of that is due to property tax refund program, you know, both in the homeowner segment as well as other segments.
Does that indicate, Mr. Showalter, that there's been, because of an increase in the property tax, that and more people qualify for it, or is it better information of people now applying for it?
The latter. So better information on, and better estimates of what the actual income growth was for the people who are applying for it.
the actual income growth came in a little bit lower than anticipated. As a result, more people were qualifying, more people were getting refunds under the program.
Okay.
In human services, $23 million change overall. That's about 0.2% change. Some increases in the general assistance medical care program, offset somewhat by slightly lower spending in the MA family and kids program. Some of that is due to a delayed implementation of the health match system. One is on a percentage basis. One of the most significant things going on is an increase in the CD program, both in terms of placements and costs. Within debt service, you see a $37 million decrease. You're probably familiar with this from past forecasts. When we go out to sell bonds, if interest rates are favorable, we will get an upfront one-time payment. That is what is due, causing this downer for 2008 and 2009. If the interest rates were to change, that would potentially change as well. All other, not too many things going on. Corrections estimates about on track, leading to the total change in $66 million in spending estimates. Just a couple of things for your information that we highlighted on Friday. The 3% debt limit, which is used to set one of the standards for the size of the capital budget based upon the non-dedicated revenues to the general fund. With this forecast, as you heard earlier, our revenues are going down. As a result, the capital bonding limit associated with that is also going down to $965 million. Within the forecast, however, we have an assumption of a 10-year rolling average, so that figure is $645 million. The debt service and the assumption for that is included in these expenditure estimates. The last thing is in other funds, we focus in the forecast release on the general fund. It is the largest and certainly the place where all of the activities focus. On the other hand, there are a number of other places where revenues and expenditures are made within the state government. We are putting together, the last year or so, we've been putting together a document called Non-General Funds. It takes some of the more technical information that we have and boils it down. We just completed it this morning. It is going on up on our website today, and we'll make sure that it, that information is sent to your staff, Mr. Chair, so that it can go on.
Members, Mr. Scholl, members, that is in your packet, I believe.
You got it. Great.
And it's, or it's been passed out. It is a non-general fund, a fund balance that's available, and you can take a look at that. And this is an important document to have. Okay. Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, members, just a quick highlight a couple of those funds, including in here one of the larger changes in spending actually occurred not in the general fund but in the non-general fund, health care access fund, where we saw enrollment decline from earlier estimates. So as a result, the balance in that fund has gone up to about $298 million by the end of this biennium. Trunk Highway Fund also has had some discussion so far since then, the special session. That fund is about in the same place, slightly higher balances in the first biennium. Those erode over time because the revenues going into the Trunk Highway Fund are economically sensitive, and some of those are coming in below previous estimates. So that is the abbreviated version of the spending issues in this forecast, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fowler, there was a question on your last chart on the inflation factor, and maybe you can answer why this is included, since it's the law says you're not supposed to include it.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Kahn, this last chart in the book shows what is projected to go out in 2010 and 11, both for revenues and spending, and the difference between those years. It has been the practice. We try to make sure that the forecast gives you as much information as possible. Make sure you have a detailed understanding of what's going on in the economy and hopefully the spending side as well. One question that's been coming up through the year, whether it's included in law or not included in law, is how much is the effect of inflationary pressure? Not necessarily specifically what health inflation versus education inflation versus gas price inflation, but what's the discretionary inflation pressure that's in the forecast. So although it's not part of our official estimate for 2010 and 11, we wanted to make sure you had that information.
A couple of questions. The debt capacity forecast states that there's an authorized and unused and unencumbered general obligation bond the present time totaling $709 million. It seems to me that that's kind of high at the present time, and do you have a report of where those is located? What projects those are?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly get back with more detail on that. Before the hearing, I got a little bit of information. Certainly, two large bonding bills occurring in the last couple of years. That's where most of it's coming from. A little over $400 million of it is from the 2006 bonding bill. Another large chunk is coming from the 2005 bonding bill. As Dr. Simpson alluded earlier, once a bonding bill is enacted, it does not mean that finance will rush out to the market and ask for bonds for that entire amount right away. If we did that, we would lose tens of hundreds of millions of dollars in lost interest. We would be sitting on money that we couldn't invest, and we'd be paying interest on it, or we couldn't invest it and be sure of returns on that. So what we do is we issue those bonds as needed. Since capital bonding projects pay out over a long period of time, 15% normally close out the first year, another 35% the second year, another 35% after that, another 13.2%. That's our sort of assumption on an entire bonding bill. That means that we're not going to go out and issue all of those bonds right away.
Will we have a report of those that are available and unencumbered shortly? I think you should give one to us in January sometime. Is that correct? Our finance may do that instead of you.
Mr. Chair, I would be Southland, Assistant Commissioner with Treasury and Debt Management. I'm not sure that this is the year we provide the cancellations report, but we can certainly get that information.
Okay, we'd appreciate that. Members, other questions at all? There's one other thing that's in the big book that I wanted to just ask a question on as you look at it. And that is in 2010 and 11, there's a projected education increase of $104 million. I think it's on page 65 of the big book for your planning. That seems kind of large because student population is going down, and you base this on current law, and there's no inflation applied to that. Can you give us some information on why that 104 is kind of in there? And if you don't have that now, I think both Representative Greiling and myself and others may be interested in where that number is coming from.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. That is really tied to the slight increase that I mentioned in 2007 pupil units that continued through the entire forecast period. That is a large portion of that. There's a more detailed discussion of education finance on page 47 of the document as well. You'll see there that while it is true that pupil units have been declining and that it's been very stable, very sort of flat for the last several years, we are starting to see some increases in 2010 and 11. And there's a graphic on page 47 that illustrates.
Okay, good. Other questions? There's a couple of things that we need to do for Ways and Means. The minutes for the Ways and Means Committee of November 9th and May 20th are in your packet. Representative Carlson would move those. All those in any corrections or additions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. Members, as you go out the door, the request for reimbursement for expenses are there. Would you fill them out and get them to me as soon as possible? Get them to the staff as soon as possible?
Yeah,
Representative Carlson?
On that point, those of you that are members of the Finance Committee but not members of Ways and Means, we indicated we would be covering your costs, so if you could get your ARBU forms to either Lil or Joanna, you'll be treated separately from the Ways and Means Committee members. So,
okay.
But your costs will be covered.
Okay. Other things? Dr. Stenson, Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Showalter, thank you very much for your time. It was a very informative meeting, and we appreciate very much you coming before us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
With that, the meeting is adjourned.